Good evening. You're listening to WNUR 89.3 HD1, Evanston, Chicago. I'm Brendan David Prizeman.
And I'm Brandon David Condritz. This is WNUR News at 6.
Tonight, a look into the dorms nobody know.
Hey, Brendan, look what I found in the corner. A styrofoam head.
Well, Brandon, I'm in the middle of reading the headlines.
Brendan, how could you forget? It's special broadcast day. The music was literally different.
Oh, yeah, of course. Wait. Did you say a styrofoam head?
You bet. Don't worry about it. And I bet things are going to get much weirder anyway.
In this quarter's special broadcast, we're going to be exploring everything from Northwestern's weirdest dorms to high school horror stories,
to Northwestern's most mysterious library branch and a film with zero views,
and everything in between. Buckle up. We've got our most packed special broadcast in years. We are running a little tight on time this evening, so we may not be able to play every story entirely, but each story will be fully available on our website, WNURnews.org.
Everything and more coming up from Northwestern University. This is Niche Western, Nooks, Crannies, and Corners.
Let's start with something everybody knows about, the dorms. But they're not all equally known. In recent years, several former sorority houses on Northwestern's South Campus have been converted into small residence halls. Often forgotten, Ella Smith and Rachel Spears provide a glimpse into the lives of the residents of Northwestern's smallest dorms.
Into 1856 Orrington, Northwestern University's sorority quads are home to several small dorms, all with strange numbers in their names. Relatively unknown except to their residents, these dorms offer a different point of view to student life at Northwestern. Many of these smaller South Area dorms are converted sorority houses. 1871 Orrington, the recently refashioned Kappa Kappa Gamma House, was home to Meghan Markle, Duchess of Sussex. Natalia, a Weinberg freshman and resident of 636 Emerson, another old sorority house, says that most people didn't know that there were residence halls nestled within the sorority quads.
They're like, oh, do you live in the sorority? It's like, no, I just live in an old one.
While older than 1838 Chicago and Allison, they have their modern touches. One second year, Joshua, compared his dorm last year, Bob, to his experience this year in 1871 Orrington.
The facilities are definitely nicer.
Alan, a Weinberg freshman in the same building, also shared his opinions.
It's somewhat old of a building, but I think just the experiences overweigh that.
While home to fewer residents, many of them included newly renovated bathrooms and large study and social spaces. A first year living in 1871 Orrington, Sheridan enjoys using the space.
So there's a lot of places on the main floor to study, which I really appreciate. There's a beautiful like sunroom out there that you could just sit and like it gets a lot of nice light. So that's probably my favorite.
Every time I bring someone new, they're like, oh, it looks so nice.
That was Natalia, who likes showing off her dorm to her friends. The social life in these small dorms can rival some of the more popular residence halls.
I guess it's easier to meet people and get along with them since there's not that many people you're interacting with, and I prefer that.
Muha is another first year that echoed those same sentiments. We found him spending time with friends in his dorm's basement. He chose his small dorm because it offered continuous housing over winter break, something that he needs as an international student.
You get to know people more at a personal level. If it's too large, you don't really interact with everyone. If it's small, like, there's more opportunity to interact with people.
While most liked their dorms, others had some minor complaints. Joshua lives south, where most of the converted sorority houses are. This can be quite inconvenient, especially when most of his classes are in tech, which is about a half mile away.
This year, I'm happy to be living with my friends, but it's a little difficult to be walking so much here and there.
Another student, Isaac, expressed some discontent about the difficulty of trying to meet people during the first few weeks of school.
Especially at the start of the year, coming onto campus, it was really hard to meet new people in such a small dorm, like especially in a 30-person dorm.
There are certain challenges faced by students living in dorms of all sizes, but overall, it seems that Northwestern's smallest dorms provide students with a tight-knit community, and the historic charm of the building certainly doesn't hurt.
I like how close everyone is. All the freshmen are very, like, nice to each other, and we hang out all, like, every day. I also like how it looks like a house. It feels very homey.
For WNUR News, I'm Rachel Spears.
And I'm Ella Smith.
Well, that was certainly interesting. 636 Emerson is one of my favorite hidden dorms, so just wanted to put that out there. But speaking of buildings that nobody really knows about on campus, have you ever thought about how much knowledge our library holds? Obviously, it's a lot, so there's going to be a lot of buildings to hold it all. Of all the nooks and crannies in the Northwestern library system, though, Mika Ellison and I might have found the one that holds the most knowledge. We have the scoop on Oak Grove, Northwestern Library's most mysterious branch. You can find the full piece on WNURnews.org. Again, we're running a little short on time, so we'll play the best clips for you.
So, where are we going?
Mika, we're going to Oak Grove.
When you think of the libraries at Northwestern, you think of Maine, Deering, maybe even Mudd.
But there's one library nobody really knows about.
From my understanding, Oak Grove is this like amorphous storage facility that has a bunch of materials in it that don't fit in the normal library, like they don't get checked out enough to like stay in the normal library.
Yeah.
And it's like a climate controlled facility. There's like a van that goes there. It like picks books up.
Uh-huh.
And no one ever goes there. No one knows what,
yes,
Oak Grove is.
Northwestern describes Oak Grove Library Center as a high density shelving facility with state-of-the-art climate and temperature controls.
Tucked back in a nondescript office complex on the outskirts of Chicagoland, the unassuming building houses roughly 2.7 million books, archived items, and secrets.
I work at the library circulation desk. Every day, the Oak Grove van shows up, picks up some books, drops off others, and then leaves. But I've always had so many questions. How many people work at Oak Grove? How big is it? What's in there?
Rumors abound about Oak Grove. I've heard that you have to have biometric access to get in. I don't know who told me that. And also, I heard that there was a boat.
A what?
It. Someone said a boat or an ark, which I think an ark and a boat are possibly different.
To get some answers, we sent Oak Grove's coordinator, Chris Karch, an email. Eventually, after some back and forth with Northwestern Libraries, we got this back.
We are happy to have you and Brandon visit the Oak Grove Library Center. I want to make sure you understand that the facility is located in Waukegan, Illinois, about a 45-minute drive from campus. You will need to provide your own transportation. You should allow about 3 hours for your entire visit.
So, what do you think we did?
We rented a car, and we went.
We're doing it for content.
The things we do for journalism and content. We're behind a garbage truck now.
Whoa,
that's how early we are.
That's crazy. What is that machine?
Oh, yeah. Slow down to get around.
I'm going
around. Got it.
Before we knew it, we were there.
Oak Grove Avenue! Stop.
Just like we thought, the building wasn't much. There weren't many cars in the parking lot, the entire building was painted the same shade of gray, and only a small Northwestern sign signaled that we were in the right place.
Well, okay, so there's a front door that I can kind of see. It looks very, like, nondescript.
Yeah.
Like, that's how I would describe this building, as nondescript.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's nothing here.
Like, I would have missed the Northwestern
sign. It's a gray,
sign.
It's a literal, just a gray building. This is crazy.
Okay, let's do it. Should we go?
Yeah, let's do it.
Chris welcomed us inside to, again, an unassuming building. Tile floors, fluorescent lights, and a few tidy workstations. We met two of his three employees, Fernando and Matt, and Chris started our visit with a little history.
I've been here since 2011. I mean, I call it 2012 usually, because it's December 2011. And then Fernando's been working here as long as I have. Matt's been here for seven years.
Oak Grove was built in 2011, and it sits on 5 acres of land, most of which are still undeveloped. Although its crew may seem tiny, what they do is no joke. They currently have the capacity to move 300,000 items into storage each year.
Obviously, they were working on the morning we chose to visit, so they showed us how an item moves through the facility and finds its forever home on the shelf. Among the items they were cataloging that day included a simple music theory book and a plate from the Ming Dynasty.
It all starts in the transport van.
So here's the van. There's plenty of room. We can fill it up with huge carts.
I'm curious, what's on the cart right now? Can you tell us what these are on the cart?
This is a Mudd Library request. It's just a standard UL item.
Okay.
Going to Mudd Library. And it looks like these are all... This is going to law.
The drop-offs for the day had already been taken off the van. They were waiting to be dusted by a special machine that looks like a cross between a vacuum cleaner and a table saw.
So the idea isn't to vacuum every page, it's just simply to give the book a once over to get any of the dust that's on the outside of the book cleared off.
Then the books are measured. They get a barcode stuck on their outside cover. And they get plugged into the comprehensive system that runs Oak Grove.
Just to attach the book to the tray, and then later on it's going to be attached to the shelf.
It's a two-step process, initial entry and verification. The two are always done by separate people, because this step is serious business. If an item is miscategorized or assigned to the wrong shelf, it's literally lost. Forever.
I assume that this happens less, because at the library everyone has access to the shelves so things can get messed up, but do you ever, like, lose things? Or you're like, no?
No, we've never lost anything.
Oh!
The books are placed in their assigned tray, which goes onto a regular library cart.
Once the cart is full, there's only one more place to go. The shelves, which the crew refers to as the modules.
Yeah, we're going back.
Airlock? Yes, it was an airlock.
So now in order to get into the module, you need your wild card needs to be set up for it through the lock shop, and you need your fingerprint set up through me.
That's that biometric access,
yep.
Mika.
Someone said biometric access, and we were like, no way.
Yes, way. It suddenly got very... Oh, my yes. God. Are you kidding me? This is insane.
What?
Whoa.
This is crazy.
Initial thoughts?
It's so deep, and it's so tall.
Mm-hmm. Module 1 was built first, and Module 2 followed about 5 years later. All told, each module has 8 aisles, is 30 feet tall, and 220 feet long. They're always kept at the same exact temperature.
50 degrees.
Always 50 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
On the nose.
Always. 35% relative humidity. Always.
The effect is like a giant book-filled Costco freezer section. Oh, and they have a forklift. That's how they get the books on the shelves.
The weight of the books alone, which are over 1 million volumes strong in each module, would make a regular floor buckle. Luckily, the floors and shelves of the modules were built to withstand that pressure and ensure the staff's safety.
We have a super flat floor. Literally, that's what it's called.
Super flat.
Super flat.
Very technical.
It is. It's called a super flat floor. I know. That will minimize when you're 30 feet up, that, you know, that difference. If your floor isn't level, then you're not going to be level. And obviously, the higher up you go, the bigger chance of anything tipping. And those things are even designed where they won't go up if it's too heavy.
At this point, Chris encouraged us to take a deeper look. So we took off and wandered the aisles for a little.
Records of the NU band program, 1917 to 2007.
You know that Kevin Leonard has been here.
Oh, absolutely. And I would love to be here as well, like all the time. I want them to just let me like walk around
Until
here.
What is kind of...
There is a boat.
The boat! We found the boat.
Holy shit.
We found the boat.
We found the rumored boat. Turns out we were in an aisle full of artifacts. We found everything from a giant atlas to a bass drum to a wooden chest from the Chicago Tribune.
This is so cool. I mean, this is just the coolest place I've ever been. Like, I'm not even gonna lie to you.
And that certainly is a story that you should check out on our website, wnurnews.org. I think Brandon and Amika have been agitating for that since... probably the start of fall quarter.
Yeah, that is the truth, Brendan. Mika and I have really been looking forward to that. We pitched it, and we've been for months been wanting to do that. So had a good excuse to do it for this time. For this
and it
podcast,
certainly so. Did not disappoint. So thank you all for that.
Thanks.
Pivoting a little bit from libraries to screens, as screen time skyrockets and TikTok becomes even more bizarre, social media users may find themselves wondering, where do all these wacky trends come from? Join Aiden Chung, Sydney Fainer, Basil Free, Yumi Talud, alongside guests Celeste Schumann and Casey Weissman as they unravel the mysteries behind the various sides of TikTok. Once again, we're a little short on time, so you can find the full piece on WNURnews.org.
Let's go around and introduce ourselves. I'm Sydney Fainer. I'm a sophomore studying RTVF. And my daily average on TikTok would have to be divided between my phone and my iPad, which I don't have here with me right now. So let's just say it's high.
Hi guys, my name is Aiden Chung. My pronouns are he, him. I'm a sophomore studying journalism and economics, and my average daily TikTok screen time is 42 minutes.
Hi, my name is Basil Free. I use he, him pronouns. I'm a sophomore studying journalism and art history. I personally don't use TikTok, but I do dabble a bit in flop talk through YouTube compilations.
I respect a YouTube compilation, and Instagram reels, one might say. I'm Yumi. I'm a sophomore studying journalism, and last week I spent 8 hours and 23 minutes on TikTok total, but today is Sunday, the beginning of the week, and I haven't opened TikTok like in the morning at all yet, but my screen time is still 42 minutes. So, yeah.
I'm Casey. I'm a sophomore studying composition, and my pronouns are he, him. And it says my daily average is 34 minutes on TikTok.
Pretty good. Yeah. Hi, I'm Celeste. I'm a sophomore studying theater. And my average is 1 hour and 50 minutes. Hi.
Yeah, you ate that.
Okay. So just to start with, let's go around and say some of the weirdest parts of TikTok we've ever seen, like niches of TikTok that you've seen, and let's see how obscure they really are.
Well, I think where the origin of kind of those TikTok subgenres come from is the war, I guess, that started during 2020, like COVID time, with straight TikTok versus alt TikTok.
Mm. Wait, who was on alt TikTok? Be honest.
Oh, I have the photo evidence prove it.
No, you weren't.
I feel like if you were on alt TikTok, you would know.
And you can find that entire story on WNURnews.org. That's a roundtable from some of our sophomore reporters about weird and strange sides of TikTok. Most film nerds, kind of switching gears from TikTok to film, most film nerds like to say that they've seen the most underground indie film of all time. But one of our reporters, Sophia Quesa, has actually done it by watching Weaver's Crossing, a film with zero views on Letterboxd. Let's hear from Sophia about what that was like.
I feel like we've all gone through this scenario. You watch a movie or a show or read a book, and when you try to talk about it with someone else, they haven't seen it. Eventually, there is an extreme point where you exhaust your list of friends and you just have to settle on the idea that the media you've consumed is at least somewhat obscure. But how obscure can you get with this? I pose this question to two people very familiar with the world of film.
There's a Ken Russell film called The Devils, based upon an Aldous Huxley book that a big studio paid for, that ended up giving, in the early days of the rating system, like an X rating in the early 70s.
That's Kyle Henry, an associate professor of radio, television, and film at Northwestern. As for the other person's most underground film,
probably this French film called Cosmos. There's six vignettes. One of them is about this filmmaker who was really bad at like interviews and everything, and he like can't get his words out about what his films are about or anything. And it's just like his little pot.
That's Angelina Randazzo, a first-year RTVF major at Northwestern. Now, while Randazzo and Henry both have their opinions, a question arises. How can you measure obscurity? Unfortunately, there's no universal tool. However, a good metric can be found in the view counting feature on the film review site Letterboxd. While it's not a perfect estimator, the site hosts around 10 million users, so it's a decent sample size. On the site, The Devils has a decent 60,000 views, while Cosmos has a smaller 2,500 views. Now, depending on your definition of obscurity, you may find these films to fit under that category. But what about obscurity to the highest degree? A film with no views on Letterboxd? Such a film exists in a little place called Jackson County with the 2015 movie Weaver's Crossing. The movie is directed and written by James Ian Mayer, who owns the small production company Moonlight Films, which distributed this project. The story is billed as a dramedy about recently retired Sheriff Henry Turner and his estranged son Jason, who returns home to take his father's job, while an intrepid journalist chronicles their relationship for her newspaper. It's got comedy, it's got drama, it's got good journalism representation, and it was available on YouTube. So, on a Monday night, Angelina Randazzo and I sat down to become the inaugural Letterboxd viewers of Weaver's Crossing. I'll play a clip of our reactions to a scene where Henry has his second heart attack in the 63-minute movie.
No!
Oh, no. Henry, are you all right?
Well, I'm on the floor, so I don't think I'm all right.
Okay,
I'll get you pills.
It's not going to work this time. Chekhov's heart attack.
Take it easy, take
How
it easy.
How about you call a hospital?
Are you feeling a little bit better?
Dude, he's actually going to die this time.
I think I can set up a little bit maybe.
You're joking.
To put it briefly, it was an experience. Randazzo has her own thoughts.
There was a lot of chances for it to be profound. There was a lot of chances for it to be emotional that they ruin.
Now, while Randazzo didn't care for some of the plot choices, she did appreciate some of the editing.
I mean, like, the audio was always clear. You could always hear what they were saying. There were like weird cuts and everything, but I mean, nothing like insanely weird.
So it's safe to say Weaver's Crossing got a mixed review from Randazzo, but she also raised a valid question.
I want to know how this was promoted, though.
So how does a film like Weaver's Crossing get distributed and end up on a site like Letterboxd? Kyle Henry, the RTVF professor we heard from earlier, also happens to dabble in self-production and distribution, and he has some answers.
You don't need a lot of money right now to make a film anymore. Digital cameras are so cheap. You know, you can get editing software that's really cheap for your laptop. Making the work can be a friends and family affair.
And this seems to be the case for Weaver's Crossing. The editing lines up with that of most in-computer programs like iMovie, and when looking at the cast list, there are a lot of reoccurring last names. The director, James Ian Mayer, acts in the film too. As for cameras, a lot of technical advancements have made films easier to make.
And I feel that since the means of production have gotten cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, like, listen, you can shoot a good film on your iPhone. The lenses, the 4K media processing, everything that comes with like a newer iPhone, those are more powerful cameras sometimes than what we're even shooting with within the radio TV film department.
Now, while Weaver's Crossing was made back in 2015 and therefore likely didn't have things like 4K media processing, it still looks decent. So filmmaking is easier and more accessible than ever, and more people are making movies. Then why don't we see that reflected in our cultural landscape?
Netflix, Amazon, Comcast have really bought up, gobbled up, swallowed up the competition. And they own huge swaths of the media marketplace. And so it's very difficult to find work that's made by independents or by independent artists outside of places like the Block Museum, or the Gene Siskel Center, or maybe Criterion Channel.
As well as YouTube in the case of Weaver's Crossing. So we find ourselves trapped in a cinematic paradox. More movies are being made than ever before, yet fewer and fewer are getting seen. Which is why we have swaths of movies on sites like Letterboxd with 100, 10, 5, or even 0 views. Which is unfortunate because we still need the Weaver's Crossings of the world. Kyle Henry agrees.
Just because a film is obscure doesn't mean it's not good.
And after watching this film, even though the plot may have been ridiculous at times, Angelina Randazzo found some things to appreciate about it.
It wasn't as bad as I expected it to be. I think production-wise, it was okay for something that probably didn't have like a budget at all, like just chipping out of their own money.
As for my personal take, Weaver's Crossing isn't Citizen Kane, but it doesn't need to be. Obviously, there was a lot of passion that went into this, and I think at the end of the day, that deserves a lot of appreciation. And I'm glad I could find this film and experience that, because while Randazzo and I may have been the first two viewers of Weaver's Crossing for Letterboxd, hopefully we won't be the last. Now to take us out, I'm going to play a reaction to the truly shocking ending of Weaver's Crossing. So if you're thinking of watching this movie, which I think you should, you might want to plug your ears.
He just gets hit by a car?
I think that's the end, yeah.
Well, lesson learned.
Yeah, look both ways when you drive.
Wow. Yep.
Wow, Weaver's...
Weaver was crossed.
The Weaver was crossed.
For WNUR News, I'm Sophia Quesa.
And now it's time for one of my favorite types of stories, a meta-commentary on the state of journalism. sports journalism.
If anything, Brendan is going to talk about sports journalism.
Yes.
But that's good, though.
Brendan will find a way to talk about sports journalism, yes. Sports journalism is, in fact, one of the least known professions that Northwestern graduates feed into, but it's got quite a few former Wildcats. Nearly 10 graduates per year from the Medill School of Journalism go into the field for their careers. Here are some of their stories. Northwestern's Medill School of Journalism tends to produce graduates that go into illustrious jobs. The class of 2022 alone has seen members go on to work at The Atlantic, CBS, The Associated Press, and The Washington Post. The majority of Medill alumni will go into either news reporting or some form of public relations and communications. However, according to the most recent data from Medill, 3% of the class of 2022 is working in sports journalism. While that's not exactly a massive number, it's not zero, either. The Medill School typically churns out about 5 to 10 graduates a year who stick to the sports beat post-graduation, as evidenced by many recent graduating classes. These are some of their stories. Daniel Ollinger is one example of an alum from the class of 2023 who works in sports journalism. Ollinger covers the Philadelphia 76ers for the Rights to Ricky Sanchez podcast. Ollinger blogs and podcasts for the site, which is very much a familiar feeling for him. While at Northwestern, he became the editor-in-chief of the sports blog Inside NU, which exclusively covers any and all Northwestern sports. Ollinger says working for the site helped him figure out how to best use his sports writing talents.
You get out to what you put into it. So, like, just being willing, they had a great women's basketball team my freshman year. I wrote about them a ton. I broke down all their zone. I did a ton of film runs on them. I was willing to write it. Through that, I got promoted to, like, managing editor by the people running it at the time, just because they saw that I was writing good stuff and clearly invested in it. And then the next year through, I got promoted to editor-in-chief after my sophomore year because, again, I was writing stuff all the time, doing film rooms, contacting people to set up good stories. But that was a good thing. It did feel just like whoever does some the most work or the best work kind of gets rewarded for it. I kind of like just that pretty basic cause and effect thing to it. So I just kind of kept working at it. And yeah, it was just, it wasn't anything special. It was just I kind of correctly identified where my talents best fit at Northwestern and kind of just let it go from there.
Patrick Andrus was also a member of the class of 2023, but ended up graduating with the class of 2022. Much like Ollinger, Andrus credits his time at campus publications with helping make him who he is today. For Andrus specifically, he basically went from illustrious publication straight to illustrious publication. During his undergraduate career, he wrote for the Daily Northwestern, and after a brief stint at the Toledo Blade newspaper, now works for Sports Illustrated. While he did learn a lot about the industry and writing at the Daily, the lessons he treasures most are ones that came outside the field of journalism proper.
I almost think I learned more of how to be a human being than I did a journalist with the Daily. And I learned a lot about being a journalist at the Daily, covering football and covering men's basketball and various other sports. And I think that that's the case for a lot of different publications. And I think we're blessed in that regard to have all these different publications from the Daily, Inside NU, MBN, WNUR, more specialized publications that are escaping me at the moment. But I think yeah, that's definitely one of the draws in Northwestern for me. And in my time with the Daily, it was special. I'll always treasure it.
Both Andrus and Ollinger also talked about the networks they were able to form while at Northwestern. They both believe that Northwestern was the right choice for them because Medill was able to provide something they've needed in their professional careers.
Well, I knew I was interested in eventually getting the Sports Illustrated, and I knew people that if I needed someone to vouch for me within Sports Illustrated, there were people there I knew, people I knew from Northwestern, and I think that has remained the case, is that I feel like I have connections in a lot of different places inside and outside the journalism industry. I think it has provided a sense of security in that regard, just knowing that I think, again, it goes back to kind of the shared experience of Adil, the shared experience of looking for jobs in journalism, which can be scarce, I think.
While the people were a key part of Olinger's college experience, Medill's biggest aid to him was its platform. As he explains, being able to write at a well-known school under a well-known program enabled him to more easily find professional opportunities.
Northwestern does, like, because it's a good school for good reason, it has these resources, you're being given a platform. No one really knows anyone's internal talent level, knowledge, what they're capable of. What's different, the differences we can see is that certain platforms are bigger than others. Northwestern did offer that to me, where it's a platform like for me to, like, maybe if I had gone to a small school, like, you know, there were small local colleges near me, I could have done other stuff. Maybe I would have still got it, ended up going into sports writing, and maybe I still would have been just as good at it as I am now. But I doubt people would have recognized it as much. So I was just talking about, like, a local B3 school they heard of, or, you know, just not doing as much. Like, it's just the fact of the matter that those things don't get as noticed as much.
Those networks and connections can even be created in the graduate school. J.P. Acosta attended Florida Atlantic University for undergrad, but came to Medill for graduate school thanks to the encouragement of his professors. Since completing the master's program, he's gone to work for sports blog SB Nation, for which he publishes lots of analytical football content. He already boasted professional experience and lots of college publication work, but Medill helped bring his journalistic acumen to another level.
When I got to Northwestern, I got to Medill, I think the skill that I developed was confidence in what I do. I think because of what I do now, I do a lot of analytical film descriptions, content for football. I realized at Medill, one of the things I was able to do was effectively communicate those things that are happening on the field to people, to students who, or some of my friends, honestly, who didn't really see the game the way I did. So I think going to Medill, one of the skills that I learned is just the confidence in knowing this might not be for everybody, but I know that I'm really good at this and I can continue to work in this lane.
Acosta also acknowledged the level of access to the journalism world Medill gave him was beyond anything else he had experienced in the undergraduate world.
I think the first thing that I would say is it gives you incredible access to the world of journalism. Not only the individual, like, here's the things that you're going to be honing and refining. Like I said, there's video, audio, print. You can do so many different things in grad school, but I think it's more just the access to all the alumni networks, the people who are well connected in the industry. You're more than likely going to find someone who does the same thing that you do, and you can kind of connect with them and be able to talk with them. The professors have extremely high amounts of experience, and you're never going to feel alone walking through the world of journalism.
Indeed, that sense of community has remained with these sports journalists long after they marched back through the arch. All of them treasure their time at Northwestern and remember it very fondly. Whether it was covering sports or just being around fellow students, their time on campus holds some of the highlights of their lives thus far. For Andrus specifically, it's an experience he's done his best to keep alive.
And then I was able to move back to Evanston for 6 months last year. And now I'm based in Chicago, although I've been making this phone call from my family home, which is kind of funny. But I think that I always tell people I feel like between graduating early and then post-grad, I've kind of orbited Northwestern since graduating.
An orbit like that only makes sense. When you've been part of a community this tight-knit and talented, you never want to leave it. For WNUR News, I'm Brendan Prizman.
Thanks for that wonderful story, Brendan. As a fellow Medill student myself, it was great to listen in and hear some insight from some recent alumni. Shifting gears a little bit, There are a lot of weird things that happen at Northwestern, and it seems like everyone has a story. Alyssa Rubin, Ilse von Heimberg, and Mary Amelia Weiss sat down with some Northwestern students to find out some of their strange stories. The full piece is available at WNURnews.org.
Out of the corner of my eye, I've seen a lot of weird stuff at Northwestern. I'm sure some of it comes with being a college student, and some of it comes down to our campus specifically. My fellow WNUR News reporters felt the same, so we asked some Northwestern students to share their own moments of obscurity. Let's just say, the class of 2028 members should listen at their own risk, because things get weird.
Hi, my name's Alyssa Rubin, and I'm an RTVF major.
Hi, my name's Milena Wolf, and I'm a bio pre-med.
Hi, my name is Ashley Wong, and I'm a journalism major.
My name is Ilse von Heimberg, and I'm a journalism major.
And my name is Mary Amelia Weiss, and I'm a journalism major.
A few days ago, we asked a few of our friends to tell us about their craziest on-campus stories. We met with people who always surprise us with what they have to say. Today, everybody sat down to record.
I guess the first question I should ask is, what's the weirdest Northwestern-specific thing you've seen here? Or, like, something that you think is real, like, weird based on Northwestern. I mean, I can start by, like, saying that, like, I feel like the scooters are so weird. I get hit almost every day by these scooters of, like, these athletes, like, wheeling around on their little mopeds, like, on the sidewalks. Like, I feel like that doesn't happen anywhere else. Like, no one else, like, fears for their life when they walk outside of their dorm.
I was gonna say, like, I haven't seen any other TikToks about the scooter issue. Like, I'm sorry, if it's, like, a universal issue, like, it's gonna be on TikTok, and, like, it's not.
Yeah. I also, like, don't really understand why we have scooters, and, like, even the athletes with their, motorbikes. Yeah. I'm, like, we have a 15-minute walk campus to north to south. 20
we all have
if you're,
to do the walk.
Exactly, like 20 if you're feeling slow that day. But, like, it does not constitute a scooter, in my opinion. Get some fresh air.
No, but that's a good one, because, like, when my parents came, they were like, why are there so many mopeds at Northwestern?
Yeah, and there's, like, three or four people on a moped at any given time. I think yesterday I saw, like, four people, like, conjoined at the hip, you know?
Yeah.
That's so unsafe.
Especially outside of Bob. You go outside of Bob because the athletes live there, at least the underclassmen, and there's, like, 75 mopeds, and it's the bane of my existence when in the middle of the night you hear their little, like, alarms go off. You hear beeping, like, I don't know why, but something happens and you'll hear, like, a nah! And my window is right above it, and I hear it, and I wake up and I'm like in a start. It's awful.
I think it's so cute when you see, like, two or three, like, grown men on the same moped. They're, like, yes, holding on to each other, like, rom-com style.
Yeah,
like,
it's so, like, romantic.
And they're gonna get off the
And transitioning from college to high school, nestled within the obscure corners of our memory lie tales about high school experiences that are as peculiar as they are unforgettable. Kara Totley has all the best high school stories, and once again, you can find this whole piece at WNURnews.org.
High school, the so-called golden years. Some swear it'll be the best time of your life, while others beg to differ. But it undeniably marks a crucial phase in someone's coming-of-age story. From getting your license, to diving into your first real relationship, to dressing up for prom, to tossing off your cap at graduation, all of those moments make you feel like you're one step closer to adulting. Despite these defining moments, there are certain incidents from high school that lurk in the obscure corners of our brains. Curious to unearth some of these weird stories, I reached out to a few college students to see what memories they've tucked away. Grad student Anthony Watts went to high school in the Chicago suburb area. He experienced a wild situation his freshman year of high school, to say the least.
I was on my way to school. I had dropped my sister off, and I was going in my cafeteria with a couple of my teammates, and randomly, out of nowhere, a deer ran into the cafeteria and broke the glass doors in the entrance. And, you know, there was about like 40 or 50 of us in this cafeteria because we had a late start. Teachers tried to keep it safe, but the deer just ran away, probably was just scared that they saw other people. And I just was at a loss of words, and that glass door has been broken for like the whole semester, and we still talk about it to this day. It was a crazy thing that at 8 a.m, you just don't expect a deer running in as you're eating breakfast. So
having random wildlife animals trying to join the student body isn't an anomaly to Anthony or even to schools within the Midwest. Sophomore Rema Peary has a similar experience, but this time with an animal from The Lion King.
I went to a boarding school in Lilongwe, which is a city in Malawi, and I was in Form 3 when the story happened. So because I went to a boarding school in the evenings, they would make us go back to the classroom area to do prep for like 2 hours, 3 hours, just to study and get us locked in. This one time my friend and I were late and everybody had already left the classroom area, so we were walking back and we were the only ones outside at this point. And on one of the football fields, we saw hyenas. And on the football field where the hyenas were was the area that we had to pass by to get to our dorms. So we had to find our way through twists and corners in the backwoods to be able to get back safely, and did.
My school was no stranger to random wildlife sightings on or around school grounds, ranging from geese to coyotes. These visits were most likely prompted by the scent of food. But maybe if I went to sophomore Nicole Moshi's high school, that wouldn't have been a problem.
But I remember my freshman year, my biology teacher, me and my friend were able to tell if it was her who was teaching or the student teacher based on the horrid smell of this teacher's lunch. She got these like frozen meals. I don't know if she just wasn't aware or just didn't care, but it was just so bad. And whenever she would finish eating them, instead of like at least throwing it in the garbage or something, she would just leave it out in the middle of the front of the classroom. And I really hope she learned how to cook after all these years, because those were horrible. So bad.
While this teacher's lunch had a...
Thanks for that, Kara. Again, you can find the full story at WNURnews.org. Imagine being dropped into a random corner of the world and being asked to identify where you are. That's the goal of GeoGuessr, the online game that became a global phenomenon over the last several years. Gabe Shumway and Edward Simon Cruz explore what makes the globe-trotting journey so appealing.
Texas, the first official
GeoGuessr world champion. He's done it from the qualifiers. He's done it.
That was the culmination of GeoGuessr's first ever World Cup event. But what is GeoGuessr? It's a video game you play using Google Maps, where you're placed in a random Google Street View location and must guess where you are. You may recognize it from your TikTok For You page, where someone happened to guess Brazil based on the red soil. It may be something that you played with your friends, determined to find out where you were. But what makes this game so appealing? What is causing this surge in worldwide popularity? Today, we set out to find the answers behind GeoGuessr's meteoric rise.
I'm somebody who really likes geography, really likes maps. As somebody who kind of has likes to think that I at least have a decent view of what the world looks like and what different parts of the world look like, this is literally just examining how well you know the world.
That's Spencer McLaughlin, a Weinberg freshman here at Northwestern. He was initially drawn to the game through a YouTube video he watched nearly 10 years ago. Even though he played the game in a history class, it never stuck until the pandemic. During that time, he picked it up again and began playing with friends regularly. Ryan Almeida is a visiting assistant professor of environmental studies at Hamilton College. He chose to become the faculty advisor of Hamilton's GeoGuessr Club after falling in love with the game under similar circumstances.
I really picked it back up during the pandemic in it probably was 2021-ish when I really got back into it. And I think a lot of people got into GeoGuessr during that time, in part due to wanderlust and sort of not being able to travel.
McLaughlin started a geography club at his New Jersey high school that quickly took to GeoGuessr as a form of entertainment. As the club gained popularity, the game became more competitive among its members.
So we had like a March Madness style bracket where everyone would compete. We also had, when we were playing casually, we had a leaderboard system where we had this really complicated Excel spreadsheet where you would put in your scores for an individual game, and it would give you like an ELO or a rating for your place in the club.
These competitions also take place at the college level, with schools competing virtually. Hamilton's GeoGuessr Club has both hosted and attended various collegiate competitions centered on the game.
You have two people per team. Each person places a guess where they think it is on the map. And then whichever guess is closest to the spot gets the most points. And the highest score from each team is subtracted. And so the difference represents sort of the score for that round. And people are given a set amount of health. And so if one team gets 4,000 points, the other team gets 3,000 points, the losing team will subtract 1,000 points from their score.
And last year, the world's greatest GeoGuessr players gathered in Stockholm, Sweden for the first ever GeoGuessr World Cup, which ended with Patrick Nordyke, known as Consus, being crowned as the eventual champion. This year's World Cup is already underway, with regional finals for the Americas taking place this weekend. Europe and Asia will have their own regional finals before the top 24 players globally square off in the two-day grand finale this September. But even if you're not a pro at identifying random spots around the world, you can still find something to enjoy in GeoGuessr.
There's quite a diversity in the way students and folks approach how they're going to figure out where they are. Some people clue straight into something like vegetation or the biome they exist in, right? Looking for whether or not the trees look tropical or whether it looks like an arid climate or whether it looks relatively temperate. Folks can be really interested in looking for things like architecture or potential language clues, right? And I think a lot of that just has to do with sort of what people naturally gravitate to when they're playing. And so I think one of the fun things about GeoGuessr is there's not really sort of one of those things that trumps the other, right? You really do need to sort of have this holistic view of the world.
For WNUR News, I'm Gabe Shumway.
And I'm Edward Simon Cruz.
Okay, I'm really excited about this next one, but first, I've got a question for you, Brandon. What do you call a carbonated sugary beverage?
I feel like this is like you're baiting me into this question. I honestly call it Coke, which I know is so polarizing because I know
that's
the debate
just wrong.
Is soda versus pop. What is it? What
no,
is
it's
it?
Just wrong.
What is it to you?
I mean, to me personally, I think it's soda or pop. They're both interchangeable. I've heard soda,
what?
I've heard pop, I've heard soda pop. My thing is, it can't be Coke because Coke is just one thing. It's like saying all tissues are Kleenex. Like, that's not the thing. There are Kleenex tissues, but not all tissues are
wow,
Kleenex.
Wow, when I wrote this in the script, I didn't know this was going to become that polarizing.
Anyway,
that's so funny.
Technically, there's no real wrong answer. Allison Rauch dove into all of your favorite regional sayings, getting to the bottom of why we call things by different names across the nation. We will have to cut this a little bit short, but once again, you can find the full story on WNURnews.org.
Down to listen to this package with some food and a drink. You've got a thick roll layered with cheese, cold cuts, maybe even some lettuce. So are you eating a sub? Or is it a hoagie? Or a hero? Or even a grinder? Okay, now you take a sip of your carbonated sugary beverage. Are you drinking soda? Or is it pop? Or even a Coke? Doesn't matter if it is Coca-Cola you're drinking. What's up with all these different words for the same things? Well, it has to do with regional dialects. Believe it or not, a country as big as the United States is bound to have some differences in speech, and it all depends on where you're from.
Yeah, so there are multiple different factors that can actually impact the reason why we have regional terms and dialects. Some of it is historical, geographical, social, and cultural factors.
That's Ashley Chung-Fat Yim. She's a research assistant professor in the Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders at Northwestern University. Chung-Fat Yim described how geography in particular plays into the development of regional dialects.
In the past, there were geographical barriers, such as like rivers and mountains, that actually created isolated communities. And over time, these isolated communities actually developed their own distinct dialect or terminology that set them apart from their neighboring regions. But we know that there's also been migration, and there's been migration patterns and language contact that led to the spread of different languages and dialect features that transferred from one region to another. So when people move to a new area, they bring their own languages with them, which can influence the local speech patterns and vocabulary.
Colonization also plays a role in shaping local dialects. While colonizers often impose their own languages, colonized people also maintain aspects of their native languages. This can lead to the creation of new dialects.
So this is actually what happened to the language that I speak back at home. I speak Mauritian Creole. And Mauritius was colonized by European countries, like the Dutch, French, British, and the interaction between like the European colonizers and African slaves laid the foundation for the development of Mauritian Creole. And French became like the dominant language of like administration, education, and culture, which is why like oftentimes when somebody who speaks French, who knows French, listens to like the language I speak with my parents, they'll recognize certain words and they'll be able to decipher like what we're saying.
Another factor that influences local dialects is immigration.
We know that different ethnic groups, they like settled into specific regions. And as a result, they brought their language and dialect with them. And over time, these like linguistic influences, they blend with the local language, creating these unique regional dialects, terms, and vocabulary.
In the Midwest, for example, high rates of Polish and German immigration led to some unique region-specific phrases.
When I first came to campus, there was a sign above the Memorial Union that said, I thought, brats on the terrace. And I thought, why would they advertise unruly little children? So I quickly learned that brats were not brats and that everybody here knew that, but not people in any of the other places I had lived. Nowadays, of course, they're all over the place, but that was a shock at first.
That's Joan Hall. She's the chief editor emerita of the Dictionary of American Regional English, or DARE. DARE is a project based at the University of Wisconsin at Madison.
It was the brainchild, really, of Professor Frederick Cassidy. And he got started first by doing a sample survey of Wisconsin to try to see whether the questions he had in mind actually had some good answers. And then he used those as the basis for the nationwide.
All right, and for our final story of the evening, it's all about museums. Going to a museum is one of the best ways to spend an afternoon. I think it's kind of hard to argue with that. But for college students, the distance and high cost of admission can be kind of prohibitive. Georgia Kerrigan and Paul O'Connor take a look at one of the most underrated free museums right here in Evanston.
For students on a budget, the Evanston museum scene can be hard to track down. Of course, there's the Block Museum, considered one of Evanston's best. But with its location right on campus, spending a Sunday afternoon at the Block might not be the most thrilling option for Northwestern students.
There's also the Mitchell Center for the American Indian, as well as the Grosse Pointe Lighthouse. But for many students, paying for admission is prohibitive. How can students enjoy a free day at a museum without hauling all the way to the Art Institute? Look no further than Dave's Down to Earth Rock Shop.
At the lake margins and in the streams were giant amphibians.
Located right near the intersection of Main Street and Sherman Ave, Dave's Rock Shop has been based in Evanston since 1970.
Its storefront offers a wide selection of items, ranging from rocks, crystals, and fossils to prints, books, and craft supplies. But many visitors have no idea that one of America's largest private archaeological collections sits right underneath in the basement. It's called the Douglas Prehistoric Life Museum and is free to the public.
To my knowledge, it's the largest private collection on display in the U.S. The shop has been here since 1970. We've had three different locations, our third location, and the biggest space we've had down here so far.
That was Jamie Gustafson, an employee at Dave's Rock Shop. He says that David Douglas, the museum's founder, got a start as an amateur archaeologist, exploring Illinois with his family. He would come to be one of the Midwest's most prolific archaeologists and excavators.
There's actually a couple of species down here that are named after the Douglas family that they discovered themselves. So they got a lot of their start with some of the stuff you see down there is from Illinois, from a formation called the Maison Creek Formation, which has a lot of really unique plants and animal life, some of which we don't find anywhere in the world other than here in Illinois. It used to be this kind of swampy fern forest about 300 million years ago, and there's actually a few species that they, digging up themselves, actually turned out to be new species.
Jamie says that Dave's career took him well outside Illinois, and even the Midwest. However, many of his most impressive discoveries took place in Illinois, specifically the Tawny Monster.
This is something that's not found anywhere in the world other than here in Illinois. It's this weird sort of alien sea creature, and you can see it right there. And so this is rare in that it only comes from here as far as we know. It's never been discovered. And what was unique about this formation is usually soft tissue does not preserve very well. Usually it's bone that does. But in the case of Maison Creek, we have all of these animals that preserved the soft tissue as well. And they kind of come in these little rock formations, these little nodules.
All right. Well, Brendan, I think that's about it for this evening. Have you discovered any fun nooks, crannies, and corners? Any personal favorites you want to share?
I mean, aside from, like, the story I did, which I tremendously enjoyed, there are some really nice corners on campus I've discovered that are great for cutting to get to places faster.
That's so funny.
Like, there's a back alley that I use to get from South to North Campus so easily, and almost no one else knows about it, so it's always quiet. It's
don't share. Keep gatekeep
oh,
it,
oh, yeah.
Please.
No, I'm going to gatekeep it.
Good.
Don't worry.
Good. The Plex pot noose is one of my favorite things. I like cutting through the courtyard of Plex. And then I'm really feeling crazy. I like cut through the grass in front of Plex and then like go like, you know, by Blom and then like in that parking lot by Blom to try and like get up to Tech. So
yeah,
it's a cool place. But all right. Well,
that's all for this
Brendan?
Yeah. Yeah, that's all for this quarter special broadcast. Niche Western. Nooks, crannies, and corners. Thank you so much for tuning in. For more news updates and reports, follow us on Twitter or X at WNUR News and Instagram at WNUR News 89.3.
You can listen to all of tonight's stories in full on our website, WNURnews.org. That's WNURnews.org. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
And we had a massive crew today.
Big crew.
Georgia Kerrigan is, of course, our lovely producer. Our reporters are Cara Totley, Georgia Kerrigan, Paul O'Connor, Ilse von Heimberg, Mary Amelia Weiss, Alyssa Rubin, Yumi Talud, Basil Free, Sydney Fenner.
The list doesn't stop there. Aiden Chung, Brendan Prizman, Rachel Spears, Ella Smith, Allison Rauch, Gabe Shumway, Edward Simon Cruz, Mika Ellison, Sophia Kesa, and myself. I am Brandon Kondritz.
And I have been Brendan Prizman. We still have one more week of shows for the quarter, so make sure to catch our next newscast on Monday evening at 6. And thank you so much once again for tuning in.
Now, back to scheduled programming. Have a great night.